So it's a great pleasure to be here. One important thing that Anton didn't mention in the introduction, which is one of my most important scientific contributions, is I'm still on good terms with the students I supervise, which includes some incredible scientists, including Anton. So this explains why I'm invited to speak here. As Anton said, the title of my talk actually combines two of my long-term interests. Quantum Hall effect has been an important topic in basic physics over the last 30 years or so, and spintronics has been, for nearly as long, been a lively and interesting topic in applied physics. And the real content of my talk concerns what is one of the most important research topics in spintronics nowadays, something called spin orbit torques. And there's no real complete theory of spin orbit torques. And you'll see that my talk is really about work in progress, not a complete theory at all. But as I'll explain, there are many hints that it's actually closely related to a quantum Hall effect, and this might be eventually an example where understanding from basic physics contributes importantly to applied physics topics. Okay, so I'm going to start by just reviewing quickly. Not everybody here is an expert on spintronics. What are the important ideas? And okay, so first thing, it's related to magnetism in conductors, obviously, interplay between transport properties and magnetic properties in magnetic conductors. Magnetism is kind of special because it is extremely robust type of collective behavior of electrons in materials. It survives above room temperature in many, many materials, including, importantly, magnetic metals. And very often, the energy gained by ordering magnetically is comparable to the entire cohesive energy of material. It's really a strong type of order, or at least it can be. So that means the fact that it's a room temperature phenomenon means it's useful for applications. So here is a cartoon of a magnetic metal. The ground state of a magnetic metal has a non-zero spin. In a mean field kind of picture, it has, which actually works quite well for most of the systems in which these phenomena are studied. You can view the state as having more occupied states of one spin than the other spin, different Fermi surfaces, if you like, for majority spins and minority spins. And in addition to all of the normal particle hole Fermi liquid type degrees of freedom of a normal metal, it has, in addition, a collective degree of freedom, which is the common spin of all of the singly occupied orbitals. And spintronics really has much to do with the interplay between this collective degree of freedom, the common spin of these orbitals, and the normal quasi-particle degrees of freedom that are involved normally in transport. So there are two parts to spintronics. One is that the transport properties of magnetic conductors depend on the state of the magnetic order, depend on the magnetic configuration. A second part is that applying bias voltages to magnetic conductors, you can change the magnetic state of the system. And so it turns out that the sensitivity of transport properties to magnetic configuration is particularly strong and particularly simple to describe in inhomogeneously magnetic ordered systems. And this effect is an example of effect that, you know, should have been discussed, could have been discussed theoretically a long time ago, but was only discussed after it became painfully obvious from experiment that this is true. This is the so-called GMR, or giant magnetoresistance effect, that for which Albert Fert and others were awarded a Nobel Prize some years ago. And here's a simple example of it in this so-called spin valve stack, consisting of magnetic and non-magnetic conductors. You can understand transport in magnetic metals using a two-channel picture. Both the majority spins and the minority spins can carry current, the first explained by Neville Mott. And so what happens is, as you know, in the periodic table, copper just has the 3D bands barely filled. The states at the Fermi level are more or less S electrons. Cobalt, in a non-magnetic state, the electrons at the Fermi level are mostly D electrons. But in the magnetic state, where you have more majority spins than minority spins, it turns out the majority spin D band is full. And the majority spins in cobalt and magnetic cobalt almost look like copper. But the majority spins look quite different. So that means that at a cobalt-copper interface for majority spins, the interface looks quite transparent. Electrons can easily go through, whereas for minority spins, minority spins can't get through into the copper because there are no D electrons at the Fermi level in copper. So if you have two magnetic layers separated by a spacer, then the majority spins can easily go through because it looks just like it's all copper, but the majority spins can't go through. So there's minority spins, I should have said. So the majority spins can carry lots of current. This is quite a conductive state. On the other hand, if you reverse the magnetization of one of these layers, and in these so-called spin valve stacks, normally you arrange things so that only one of these magnetic layers can easily be switched, then when it's switched, then you don't... The spin of the majority spin electrons is not the same in the two cobalts, and that means neither the spins to the right nor spins to the left can get through this stack. Both are reflected off one barrier or the other, so the resistance is very high. Okay? So this simple effect is can read the direction of the magnetization of, let's say, this cobalt layer, and that and has been responsible for big improvements in magnetic information storage technology. to talk about the reverse effect, this is the normal starting point for practical discussions. Equally important, although not as widely exploited up to the present time, is the fact that you can change the magnetic configuration of a magnetic conductor or magnetic system simply by running a transport current. And that's normally discussed in terms of this equation for the dynamics of M hat here, dynamics of the magnetization direction. Okay, so in these magnetic conductors, as I said, there's a huge energy that determines the magnitude of the magnetization, but there's no energy that determines the direction of the magnetization. So the direction of the magnetization can easily change. And it can change, for example, due to an external magnetic field. So the contributions to the time derivative of the magnetization, which you can derive really microscopically for most of these materials, all of the terms here are completely understood from a microscopic point of view. And so the magnetization has a dynamics, which is due to simply precession of the spins, for example, in an external magnetic field. There's also damping processes in metals. This is actually transfer of spin from the collective direction of the collective magnetization to the individual quasiparticles, so this term will, if you have a magnetization that's not aligned with an external field, this damping will gradually make it align with the external field. And what is written here on the last term on the right-hand side of this equation, STT stands for spin transfer torque. I'll explain those words in a moment. But really, all this means is that the dynamics of the magnetization is changed if there's a transport current. And so these are more generally this fact that the right-hand side of this equation changes in proportion to current or bias voltage. Normally, you're in the linear response regime. And so more generally, these are called current-induced torques. Of course, this is a time derivative of an angular momentum, a spin angular momentum. So the various terms that contribute to that time dependence, people normally refer to as torques. Okay? So so there are spin transfer torques. These were actually predicted theoretically and observed experimentally not too many years later. So what's important for my talk is one idea about this spin transfer torques that you can understand in terms of the language of these two equations. This is using the language of a mean field description for these magnetic conductors. And so I have in a mean field description, the magnet consists of a bunch of orbitals that experience a mean field due to the magnetic order, a mean field which lowers the energy of majority spins and raises the energy relative to minority spins. And so this is looking at the time dependence of a total magnetization. Then is just the time dependence of the magnetization or the quantum spin of each individual electron. And here's an equation for the time derivative of the spin. Each individual spin processes in delta here. Delta is the notation commonly used for the exchange field that produces the energy difference between majority spins and minority spins. So that's a very large magnetic field, a couple of electron volts or something. So each electron processes in that spin. But except for this contribution to the time derivative of the spin, if I didn't have this contribution, then spin would be conserved. There would be no spin-dependent terms in the Hamiltonian. And then just like charge density, I could say time derivative of the spin density is the divergence of some spin current. And so this is the top equation is for an individual orbital labeled by, in this equation, by a Greek letter alpha. So in this language, if I want to know the time dependence of the total spin density, I just sum over all the orbitals. And the main point is that the direction of this exchange field that is always, at each instance in time, is proportional to the direction of the total spin density. And so there's no torque that comes from that. The exchange field always lines up with the total spin density. So when I look at the contribution to the time dependence of the total spin, I just get a divergence of spin current. Of course, this reflects the fact that the underlying many-body Hamiltonian is spin independent, and so the notion of a spin current for each of the components of spin is relevant. So in this equation, J is the direction of current in space, but the spin current is a tensor because there's a spin current for each component of spin. Okay? And so if I took this equation and I apply it to a magnetic conductor, what that says is that if I somehow arrange that spin polarized currents, actually, because we're only interested in changing directions, that have spin polarized currents that have a component that's not parallel to the direction of the magnetization, are somehow flow in to a magnetic conductor, that produces a torque. And often this kind of torque is understood in terms of conservation of total spin. Whatever spins flow in must ultimately be transferred to the collective magnetization, and that's where the term spin transfer torque comes from. But the main point I want you to take away is that if any source of spin polarized current flowing into a magnet will produce a torque. Okay, and so the there is one example of that is using spin valve stacks like the ones I was describing for giant magnetoresistance. This is supposed to be magnetic conductors in red flowing through non-magnetic materials through a wire. And when you can use one magnet, as let's say whose direction you might arrange to be pinned all the time, as a spin polarizer, so the current flowing in a ferromagnet is obviously spin polarized in the direction of the magnetization or opposite to it, depending on the material. And so when that those spins flow through some other magnet, then they come in with the initial polarization, and it turns out they exit with the spin polarization direction of the new magnet, and so that produces a torque, which will tend to make the second magnet line up with the first one. So that can be, that's one example of how transport currents and bias voltages can be used to manipulate magnetic states, and you can use this to reverse magnetization, let's say, to write information, magnetic information. And so that effect has been studied for a long time, and people have been trying to make a technology out of that. So you could have a magnetic memory where you can read magnetic information, magnetic configurations that store information electrically, and you can write them electrically. And but now there's a new way to create spin currents that seems much better. And that new way is related to something I've been lying about up to this point. And I've been lying about the fact that spin is conserved. Of course, spin is never conserved. In any crystal, we always have spin orbit coupling. And I've written here spin orbit coupling in semi-relativistic quantum mechanics in the form that's usually appropriate for electrons and metals that travel at about a hundredth of the speed of light. And this can be viewed, of course, as we learn in a quantum mechanics class, the spin orbit coupling can be viewed as being related to the fact that when an electron is moving, it sees an electric field as a magnetic field. And so that leads to this effective magnetic field. V here is the scalar potential experienced by electrons inside some material, and this is the momentum operator, so this is non-zero for moving electrons, and it produces an effective magnetic field, that's smaller than our normal energy scales for most properties we're interested in inside a metal by the ratio of a Rydberg energy to a rest mass energy of electron, because it's basically a relativistic correction to the Schrodinger equation. And so spin orbit coupling is generally weak in some sense. Okay. So I'm going to be talking about spin currents created which are most simply viewed as being created by the spin Hall effect. I'm going to return later in my talk and talk about the microscopic theory of a spin Hall effect. That is actually what's related to what's absent. Just phenomenologically, spin Hall effect, as first pointed out by Diakonoff and Perel some time ago, is something that occurs inside any conductor, and it's there only because of spin orbit coupling. It's the spin Hall effect says that when I have current, let's say, flowing from top to bottom, left to right, in this cartoon of a wire in a conductor, then there's a flow of spins in a spins flowing in a perpendicular direction, and the orientation of that spin is the third perpendicular direction. Okay, so this is allowed by symmetry, and therefore it's there. And saying going beyond saying it's allowed by symmetry and having a quantitative theory of this effect is much more challenging. Spin Hall effect is appears experimentally in an accumulation of spins near the boundaries of the sample, because obviously these spins can't flow outside the sample, so they accumulate near the boundaries. And this was first observed experimentally only 10 years ago. Ago or so by Jürg Wunderlich and also by David Aeschlimann and their collaborators. Okay, so why is this important? So there is the spin Hall effect. It produces spin currents in any old conductor, and it's a spin current related to spin orbit coupling. It's a so-called if you can make that spin current flow into a magnetic material, it will produce a torque. So that's what the spin orbit induced torques are that I was talking about. And the reason this is really potentially much useful is that the spin transfer effect I described before, where one electron flows through a material, realigns its spin with from whatever it started at to the magnetization direction of the material that it's in, that can only produce the change in the change in spin angular momentum that it can produce is one Bohr magneton basically for every electron that is that passes through the circuit. And but if you have this spin Hall effect, then you have a conductor. Let's say this is a system I'll come back to later in which these effects are observed. If you have a charge current flowing from left to right here, the total amount of charge current is proportional, as we learned in freshman physics, to this cross-sectional area, the thickness of this film times its width, and the whereas the spin current flows perpendicular to that, and has a total spin current proportional to the product of the width of this thin film times its length divided by the thickness. So so this simple geometrical factor allows you to get much more than one spin for every electron you go through the system. And that's why this is so promising. And okay, so now let me switch gears a little bit. I'm going to come back to what's responsible for spin Hall effect later. I'm going to make some selected remarks about the quantum Hall effect, highlighting things that I think are possibly related to the spin orbit talk phenomenon. That's a picture I've always liked of Mr. Edwin Hall, who grew up in rural Maine. I feel affinity since I grew up in rural Nova Scotia, and when I drive through Maine, I think this is Nova Scotia. Actually, rural Maine, not southern Maine, where the fancy people go. So Right. So he did a good PhD. He discovered the Hall effect, which was very important in the history of physics and understanding where electrons are. What electrons were. But he also discovered anomalous Hall effect. So Hall effect is, you know, just current going through a conductor. There's a voltage appears in a perpendicular direction, or if you allow it to, a current will flow in this direction. And the Hall effect requires broken time reversal symmetry. Time reversal symmetry is broken by a magnetic field. So in a magnetic field, you get a Hall effect. time reversal symmetry is obviously also broken in a magnet. And if you have spin orbit coupling, the fact that time reversal symmetry is broken is communicated to the orbital degrees of freedom that are carrying current. And just by symmetry, it's clearly that in a spin orbit coupled magnetic conductor, there will always be a Hall effect. And he observed that just a year or so after he observed the so-called ordinary Hall effect. And this stood for a long, long time as one of the un-understood transport phenomena in metals, and until very, very recently, and possibly even till now. Okay. So although people didn't realize it at the time, a big step in the improved understanding of anomalous Hall effect was the discovery of quantum Hall effect. Quantum Hall effect, of course, was studied heavily for decades. It's a Hall effect that occurs in quantum wells and semiconductors confined to a two-dimensional plane. And it turns out that in 2D, as you all know, the Hall effect is in good quality materials is very unusual. And the people saw it experimentally as soon as they had good quality materials. Okay? It was obvious. And it was discovered, of course, by Klaus von Klitzing in the 1980s, and not anticipated by theory. The quantum Hall effect is intimately connected to kinetic energy quantization, Landau quantization of electron orbits in a magnetic field. In two dimensions, of course, electrons go in closed cyclotron orbits. In a magnetic field, the kinetic energy of that motion gets quantized, and there are gaps between Landau levels. And so what was observed experimentally is that when you have a gap between Landau levels, charge will flow without dissipation, except for contact resistance. And the Hall resistance that's measured is not zero. Okay, there's charge flows, first of all, that's maybe a surprise since there's no states at the Fermi level. And the Hall, the resistivity associated with that is absolutely, you know, perfectly quantized as far as we know, verified experimentally to part in 10 to the 10 or so. So that's the quantum Hall effect, 2D electrons in a magnetic field. In the last couple of years, the anomalous Hall effect has also been observed in quantized form. This happens, again, when there are no states at the Fermi level in a bulk system. This is an experiment from the Chi Kung Zhu group at Tsinghua University in Beijing. They're the first people to do this experiment. This is their data. Now it's been confirmed by a half dozen groups around the world. And what it is if you learn how to make a topological insulator magnetic, the surface states of that topological insulator open up an energy gap when you have broken time reversal symmetry in the magnetic state. And as predicted theoretically prior to this observation, when the Fermi level lies in that gap, you have a quantum Hall effect with no external magnetic field. And So I'm obviously focusing on the fact that it's kind of peculiar that you have transport, which we normally think as particles going in and out of reservoirs in linear response regime at the Fermi level. There are no states at the Fermi level, yet you see transport properties. And of course, in the quantum Hall effect, we understand that that there are states at the Fermi level, and they're localized at the edge of the system. And that's why you can have transport, and in fact, that's why the Hall resistance is quantized, and we have dissipationless flow. So the fact that you have edge states, you can understand in terms of the topological character of some of these states. But let me discuss it in terms of the original example, which is two-dimensional electrons in a magnetic field. So you already know, in that case, that something is peculiar about this insulator with all of these Landau levels separated by finite energies, because the number of states in a Landau level varies continuously with magnetic field. So how can that happen? If I have silicon and I have an energy gap between the valence band and the conduction band, how can the number of states in the valence band change continuously with some parameter? Obviously, it doesn't unless you close the gap. And so the way the number of electrons changes with magnetic field in a 2D electron system is there are states at the edge, and those states at the edge evolve with magnetic field such that they move into the system or move out of the system. That's how the density changes. So it's connected with how the states at the edge of the system depend on magnetic field, and it won't be a surprise, although I won't go through the algebra, that the way in which the states change with magnetic field is connected with currents flowing around the edge of the system and connected with the orbital diamagnetism of these 2D electron systems. And in fact, you can show when I have a two-dimensional electron system at equilibrium, in equilibrium, obviously it has a boundary somewhere, and that it must have edge states. And when I move the chemical potential within a gap, let's say between within a gap, then the amount of current flowing in these edge states, flowing chirally in the edge states, changes with chemical potential in proportion to the Hall conductivity. So sigma here is just the Hall conductivity in E squared over H. It's the quantized Hall conductivity. A quantized Hall conductivity that's measured experimentally just depends on having a local chemical potential at the edge, and it really is just how much edge current do I get for a given amount of chemical potential change. And so if I attach a source and a drain to these edges, you can see you can get a net current flowing by having different chemical potentials on different edges. And the same thing happens with the quantum anomalous Hall effect, that the number of states in the valence band changes with magnetic field, and there are edge states actually in that case on the sidewall of the topological insulator thin films where these experiments are done that will give a perfect quantum Hall effect if, in the transport regime, they're in local equilibrium. Okay? There's a famous rich example of the quantum Hall effect, which is when you have electrons in a magnetic field and a periodic potential. Turns out that gives a very complicated spectrum where, let's say, some tight binding band breaks up into Landau levels in a very complicated and self-similar way, as illustrated by this picture, which looks at the spectrum on finer and finer energy scales. And in each of these gaps, if there is a Hall conductivity, there are edge states. And the number of edge states is connected to the value of the Hall conductivity, and so on. Okay. So this is the main point I want to make. It's actually a calculation for this Hofstadter butterfly example, which has been an academic example until recently. It turns out we have a very good realization of that now for produced by moiré patterns of graphene sheets on boron nitride substrates. But this is just a theoretical toy model calculation, and I only want to mention one thing. First of all, it describes a band which is broken up into a bunch. It's actually a Landau level, which is broken up into a bunch of subbands, and there are gaps between them. And what is plotted here as a function of energy is the mean position of those states. So you simply, so you can tell if it's an edge state or it's a bulk state in a finite width ribbon. And for example, in this gap, you have a Hall conductivity of 1, and you have corresponding edge states. And the point I want to make is that those edge states actually don't go away when you move the energy through a region where there are also bulk states. And so these edge states still can play an important contribution to transport, even when the Fermi level lies here. And so these states away from the Fermi level in this way can contribute to transport even in conductors. Okay, so that's now let me return to discuss the anomalous Hall effect and spin Hall effect. So now we recognize the spin Hall effect and anomalous Hall effect as cousins. They're spin Hall effect is spin currents flowing in a non-magnetic conductor. You don't need, because spin is odd under time reversal, you don't need to break time reversal symmetry to get a spin Hall effect. But to get an actual charge flow, you need to break time reversal symmetry. And so the first, so as I mentioned before, you know, the theory of the Hall effect in a magnetic conductor has been in a confused state for ever, you know, since Hall did this measurement, up until maybe even today, but at least until the last decade or so. And the reason it's been hard to understand the Hall effect in magnetic conductors is that it's really partly that it's small. So here's a brief summary of the theory of anomalous Hall effect in Feynman diagram shorthand. And I'll tell you what these ideas that these Feynman diagrams stand for. And the first idea is that you can get understand a Hall effect in a magnetic conductor using very conventional ideas from the normal Boltzmann type transport theory that works so well for metals. But in order to get a Hall effect, you need to have skew scattering. So skew scattering means that electrons scatter in a clockwise direction. The probability of scattering clockwise due to disorder in a metal is different from the idea probability of scattering counterclockwise relative to the axis defined by the broken time reversal symmetry, the magnetization, say. So that's allowed when you have spin orbit coupling because of broken time reversal symmetry. But as I mentioned before, spin orbit coupling is generally speaking weak, that it's down by a factor of 1 over mc squared, 1 over the rest mass energy of the electron. And it turns out that it's even smaller than that, the skew scattering effect, because obviously, at leading order in perturbation theory, where you use golden rule, scattering probability between state and A and B is just the, you know, scattering matrix or T matrix squared, and it doesn't matter which is the initial state and which is the final state. So you have to go at least to third order in some spin-dependent disorder or some disorder potential in order to get a skew scattering effect. And so that it's very small effect. And that allows, especially, this still is the ultimately the dominant effect in a good conductor. But the systems we're really interested in aren't that good conductors. And that opens room for a contribution to the Hall effect that is represented by this, you know, in some sort of disorder perturbation theory, is represented by this rather least interesting diagram, no disorder. And so this contribution to the Hall effect is called the intrinsic Hall effect. It turns out that if you just plug in normal linear response theory formulas, the Hall conductivity of a magnetic conductor has a contribution that is obviously not proportional, doesn't diverge in the limit of no disorder, like normal transport coefficients do, but it's independent of a disorder strength, so it's, let's say, smaller than the ordinary Boltzmann conductivity by a factor of, let's say, Fermi energy times scattering time. But it depends just on the band structure, okay? So this intrinsic contribution to the Hall conductivity appeared in the first quantum transport theories of anomalous Hall effect in the 50s and papers by Luttinger and so on, but it was dismissed eventually. People all agreed that it was not right because this had to do with the properties of states away from the Fermi level. How can they contribute to transport? And so there were many qualitative arguments advanced, which were eventually more or less accepted in the community, I believe, which said that for some reason, even though standard linear response theory gave this contribution, it shouldn't be included. And it's even more complicated than that. Turns out, there are other contributions to the Hall conductivity that are the same order in a expansion in terms of scattering strength that are very difficult to calculate exactly in general. So that contribution to the Hall effect is related to Berry curvatures of the band states, how the band states change with momentum. It's related to the topological interpretation of the quantum Hall effect that I haven't discussed in detail. And it's related to all of the recent interest in topological materials, even though nothing is quantized, of course, in the case of conductors. And partly motivated by discussions with my good friend and colleague, Chun Nu, who's, as he describes himself, Mr. Berry Curvature, who has been interested in these kinds of effects in in transport of metals for many, many years. We actually said, okay, let's just, you know, that intrinsic Hall conductivity is easy to calculate. Let's just calculate it and see if it looks like experiment. And so this is actually a calculation for iron. I won't explain this in detail. Later on, it was these calculations were done for a large number of materials. And the upshot, at least, is that the experimental room temperature Hall conductivities and Hall conductivities when except for very, you know, perfect bulk metals at low temperatures seem to be this intrinsic Hall effect. And so this is really just the quantum Hall effect in iron, but it's not just the quantum Hall effect because there's other stuff going on too. These edge states associated with the quantum Hall effect and the Berry curvatures are evidently still present even though they're also bulk states. okay. You can do the same thing for any old conductor. There's an intrinsic spin Hall effect, and these were calculated by a group of Japanese researchers for a whole bunch of materials in this paper in 2008, and they discovered, for reasons which aren't entirely clear, that two of the very best, highest materials, that among the ones they looked at anyway, with the highest spin Hall effect were tantalum and tungsten. Okay. So I think actually unrelated to that, how am I doing? So I should stop in 10 minutes maybe? Okay. So I think unrelated to this, even not knowing about this theoretical work, spintronics group in Grenoble did an experiment where they put a magnetic thin film on top of a good spin Hall material, platinum. And they discovered that when they ran a current through the through this conducting thin film, they could switch the magnetization. And so this presumably is the spin Hall effect in action. Okay, so maybe I will skip this, but so if I think about this bilayer or trilayer, actually, stack of thin film stack, and I think of it as a single hybrid material. With it's a hybrid material with one layer cobalt, which provides the magnetic order, and another layer platinum, which provides the spin orbit coupling. And this system altogether will have, first of all, it doesn't have a mirror symmetry because the cobalt is not the same as the platinum. So this plane, the interface, is not a mirror symmetry. And it turns out if you think of this as a single bulk material just by symmetry, that allows a current through a single magnetic system with only one magnet rather than two, like in the spin transfer torques, to have its magnetization deflected and ultimately reversed by a magnetic field. This effect is these slides I won't go through explain, allowed by symmetry, therefore it occurs, and it has the advantage, this shown experimentally to some degree, that it has this L over T advantage that I mentioned before, that the spin Hall current, if we view it that way, flowing in the non-magnetic material can flow into the ferromagnet, and if the length of this interface between the two materials is very long, lots of spins flow into the magnet. And so you can get many more, and this is established experimentally, much bigger. You can exceed this Bohr magneton per electron limit for current-induced magnetization, collective magnetization change, and ultimately reversal. And this is very important technologically because with the spin transfer effect, the amount of current that you need to supply in order to reverse a magnetization is, the current density is very high, and it uses a lot of energy, and maybe even more importantly, it damages the material. And so this effect allows you to reverse magnetization in principle with much smaller currents. The writing information with the spin transfer torque is something people have been working on for a long time, and there are prototype devices. There are even devices you can buy, but they're only at the moment good enough for niche applications. So this spin orbit induced torque effect that I've been talking about may change that. And this could end up having a big impact on information technology. Okay, so if I have 5 minutes, then let me just end with another effect quickly related to spin orbit torques, another way to use spin orbit torques. And this is what I call spin orbit torque transistor. And I have in mind a system like this. Again, all of this is based on the properties of thin films. Here's platinum or some other good spin hull material. I did not fully emphasize on the last slide that I'm sliding over the fact that spin is this whole effect is created by spin orbit coupling. So spin is not a good quantum number. Spin currents are not really a very sharply defined thing. So what happens to this spin current at the interface between a spin hull material and a magnetic material is not so clear. And there is, in fact, at the present time, no predictive theory of what will happen at any interface and whether this spin hull torque is a property purely or nearly purely of the non-magnetic material or if it's an interface property. This is all unknown. And the ideas I was describing are really have that ultimate motivation. But this phenomenology is certainly very well established here. currents flowing in these metals at the side. Imagine they're platinum, if you like. And current charge current I sub C here flows due to a bias voltage, which I've called mu C here, the charge bias chemical potential. That's just normal conductance of a metal. But there also is a spin current, actually spins point flowing in the perpendicular direction that's induced by the bias voltage between the bottom and top of this picture. And there's a reciprocal effect that's also well known, that if there's a spin chemical potential in this ferromagnetic thin film, then it will drive a charge current in the conductor. By spin chemical potential, what I mean is a precessing magnetization. If I have a precessing magnetization, and this is can be an insulating even ferromagnet, a commonly used material is yttrium ion garnet. So this ferromagnet, if it's precessing, that's like having a different energy for spin up versus spin down. So it acts like a spin chemical potential pumps spin current out into the magnetic conductor, and through what is called the inverse spin hull effect, that creates a charge current in the perpendicular direction. although we don't have good theories of these two off-diagonal coefficients that transport, generalized transport coefficients that appear here, the phenomenology is very well established, and the numbers are even known for different interfaces. And so what that allows, anyway, is a coupling between the transport properties of the metal on the left and the metal on the right. And that's what I want to take what is illustrated in this slide. You might recognize that this is analogous to what some of you were at my talk yesterday, analogous to what happens in those systems. There's a spin current injected into this ferromagnetic insulator, Yi. A spin current, that's the jargon, or spin torque. What does it mean? It means just a contribution to ds dt for that ferromagnet. And that spin torque can be balanced by magnetic anisotropy in the ferromagnet. Magnetic anisotropy means there's a preferred direction for the magnetization in the Yig, and if I tilt the magnetization away from the easy direction for the magnetization, I also get a torque that would otherwise produce precession, and that can balance against the spin torque and produce a time-independent magnetization. So what's actually plotted here is current flowing through platinum on the right and against current flowing through this electrode on the right with no bias voltage on the right. If once you put enough of a spin torque into the Yig, that big enough that it can no longer counteract that torque with an anisotropy torque, then the spin in the Yig starts precessing. That precessing spin in the Yig pumps spins out into both sides of into the metals on both sides, and that creates a charge current through the inverse spin Hall effect that flows in this platinum, even though there's no electrical bias voltage. And what's more important is that as you can see there, there's some sharp switch that occurs in the bias voltage on both sides, or the current flowing on both sides for a given bias voltage. And that current actually is this, what this diagram shows is the most interesting case is the case here in yellow. And that is the case of a system. Lambda here stands for the domain wall width in these ferromagnets. And if the system size is smaller than the domain wall width, that means the magnetization is forced by exchange interactions to be uniform inside the material, then it turns out that the whether you start pumping or not depends only on the total spin current injected into the system from both sides. So the switching current on one side is affected by whether or not a current is flowing on the platinum on the other side. So this non-local coupling through the magnetic condensate gives rise to some kind of transistor action that might be a useful effect for a new generation of electronic devices. So I think I've gone a bit too long. I apologize for that, and thanks for your attention. Well, it can be what you like, and as you're probably well aware, you know, the progress in manipulating these magnetic thin films to get whatever you like has been progressing very rapidly, driven in part by the applications of these in magnetic memories. But A simplest case in a way is to imagine that it's a shape anisotropy, which you can easily engineer by controlling the shape of the thin film. Yeah. Of course, magnetostatic interactions are a little bit complicated, and so maybe you actually want it to be some engineered magnetocrystalline type anisotropy so that it's more local than the non-locality of the magnetostatics can make things more complicated in a way that we've mostly ignored so far. Yeah, so no experiments on any of this stuff yet. This magnetoresistive effect that I described at the beginning of my talk, that is used to read the magnetically stored information. But in the commonly used technology, the information is written, the magnetization of the little grains is reversed still in traditional way with actually Oersted magnetic field. So there are memories you can buy in which the information is both written and both written and read electrically. But at the present time, my understanding, this is not all secondhand information here, from experts. My understanding is that the main problem with these purely electrical magnetic memories is that the currents that you need to do the reversal electrically are so bad that the material is, you know, doesn't have a long lifetime. It's not as, it's a reliability issue. And the spin orbit induced torques allow you to go down by an order of magnitude. So there, I should have mentioned that one of the big players in this field is the group of Dan Ralph and Berman at Cornell University. And I know they're very quiet and optimistic about the commercial potential of magnetic memories that exploit the spin orbit induced torque effects. Right, so that's a scattering problem. But it turns out that, well, first of all, the simplest way to say it is that S electrons are more or less free electrons in copper, and the majority spin electrons in cobalt are more or less free electrons. They have an effective mass which is more or less the free electron mass, so they have a very high velocity, and they can easily conduct. You know, the, let's say in cobalt, for example, the majority spins at the Fermi level are S electrons. They have a very small density of states. The minority spins are D electrons. They have a big density of states. Nevertheless, it's the majority spin electrons that that are S electrons, are free electrons that are not tightly bound around the D electron cores that carry almost all the current.